Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with New Orleans writer Addie Kitchens, whose much-anticipated debut novel is Dominion. It is a great pleasure to welcome Addie Kitchens to The Reading Life. One of Publishers Weekly's writers to watch this fall, Addie is already getting rave reviews for her debut novel, Dominion, which comes out August 19th. Her previous work has appeared in The New Yorker, that was a wonderful short story, The Paris Review, and The Oxford American. A Mississippi native, Addie now lives right here in New Orleans. So, Addie Kitchens, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much, Susan, for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, I'm excited. I'm so excited. So tell us your New Orleans story. How did the city lure you away from Mississippi?
So it's kind of like I was taking a tour of the Southeast. I moved here one time from Tallahassee, where I was at Florida State, and then I moved here from Texas. I came twice, and then I left because I was in love. And then I came back, and I've been here ever since. And I love it because it feels like home, but bigger and better. You know?
Oh, nice. So how long have you been here this time?
Probably 13 or 14 years.
Yeah, it was a while.
It's been a while.
So tell us a bit about your process with this novel, because you were part of something new and exciting in bringing it into the world.
Yes. So this novel, I always say it started as long as I've been in church observing things, but I actually started writing on it maybe like 2012-ish, around that time, 2013. And it got to a point where I thought it was finished, but I knew it wasn't finished. So I kind of just let it sit. I have like this habit of working on a story and revolving if it doesn't work. And if I like the story, I'll come back to it.
Yeah.
So I started writing on something else and then something else. And then I came back around to the story around the time of FSG's inaugural fellowship program. And it kind of fell in my lap. I didn't even know where the draft was. It just appeared, and I entered, and I won. And I had a great editor, and I call her the book's midwife, because she asked one single question. She said, "Is this book saying what you want it to say?" And I'm like, "Absolutely not." And so that was the problem with it. All those years it had been sitting, that it wasn't saying what I wanted to say, and it just took someone recognizing it to make me able to get the rest of the story that I thought was right.
Now, we should say that FSG stands for Farrar, Straus & Giroux, which is one of the best publishers of literary fiction we have.
Yes, and they're awesome. They are. They're awesome to work with.
So you had a year of working with this editor, right?
Yes. You know, it wasn't, I liked it because it wasn't that hands-on a process. They kind of let you figure it out on your own, just asking the right questions and providing input where they did. But I feared once I got to this process, I would be silenced in some ways. And so FSG never did that. They were always very adamant about me saying what I needed to say with the text and in life, you know, as I was participating in the fellowship.
That's an important question. And it propels you through a revision, I think.
It did propel me through the revision because it had been sitting so long. And as soon as she asked me that question, I was able to get it out. And so my grandmother also used to say this thing about, she used to say, keep living. I also had to do a bit of living to be able to get, you know, take the steps that the text needed to be as powerful as I believe it is. I might be biased, though.
No, I think you're on. I think you're right there. Now, this is a story a small town, Mississippi, which you know from growing up in Clarksdale. And it's about the African-American community centered around the church and the family of the preacher Sabre Winfrey. Nice name, that one. And he owns much of the town of Dominion. He's a preacher. He owns the radio station. He owns a barbershop, a lot of real estate. And this is told in the voices of Priscilla Winfrey, his first lady, and Diamond Bailey, the young lady who falls in love with Emmanuel, his son. So that's a wonderful setup for everything, you know? It's a coming-of-age story in many ways.
Mm-hmm. And I think for both of the main characters, it's a coming-of-age story, mm-hmm. even though Priscilla's in her late 40s, early 50s, you know, it's still a coming-of-age for her. It represents the abandoning of all the things that we thought were right or correct.
I love the way you always give your women all the chances they want or will take. And their voices are so strong. I mean,
thank you.
Why did you choose this structure?
It's kind of like the structure wouldn't leave. When I had written an earlier draft, there was I had spoken with an agent who really wanted me, who loved the story, who really wanted me to change around the structure. And I just couldn't do it. For some reason, it had to be this way for me. And I think part of the structure came from like the communal choral aspect of, you know, the town's voice. Mm-hmm. Part of it is because I really wanted to get into the head of women who are like my mom, like my aunts. And I really wanted them to get their ideas out, good or bad. You know, so I wanted to hear from them. I also say I didn't. There were drafts where I used more of the men's voice, but I always say, like, cishet males are like the apex predators. And so if I'm asking their opinion in the book, it's like asking the wolf why they hunt. You know, they're just going to justify eating you. And so that's why I chose to not too much do their perspective, but you see them. Because it's kind of like men are allowed to kind of plod all over everything and all through the age, and you're just avoiding the footfalls. And
like one of the characters says, a man gun man.
Yeah, exactly.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Addie Kitchens. Her much-anticipated debut novel is Dominion. Now, Dominion is many things in this novel. It's the town where it takes place. It's the power God gives to men. And the name is affixed to all the institutions in the town. So everywhere you go, you're bumping into this.
And I think, like, my agent and my editor and I came up with the title while I was in Mexico and we were talking it out because I had a different title. And they were like, are you married to this title? I'm like, no, I'm married to what best tells the story, you mm-hmm. know, best represents the story. And so we kind of just batted, like, different words around and that Dominion came. And I was like, it's perfect because I think, you know, you call in a town in Mississippi Dominion for one. You know, I think there's a lot of like stuff you can read into that. You know, it's Mississippi. So, mm-hmm. And I want to express also how your so-called Dominion is relative to whatever power you stand in at that moment. And so even in the end where you have this very powerful man in this town, you see in the end how relatively insufficient his dominion is mm-hmm. at the end, you know.
And I love the power in the women's voices and how they exercise it. The other thing I really love is that Priscilla does drafts for her husband's sermons. And they come out on a piece of paper that says across the top, I'm just a nobody trying to tell everybody about somebody who can save anybody. And I always pay attention when a writer writes a sermon, you know, because I think they have a lot of fun doing it. Did you?
I did have a lot of fun doing it. And if you see some of the sermons and you see like where they come from, some of them are really wild. And because the Bible, you know, if you go through it, it's like got some really strange things in some parts of it. And I very much enjoy going through a Bible study, as my mama would love to see me doing genuinely. But I genuinely loved going through the Bible to pick out these passages. Uh-huh. So, you know, it was very fun to write. And I'm an Aries, so I always have my cause. I always have my...
I'm an Aries too. I know what you mean.
What's your birthday?
April 8th. When's yours?
My mom's birthday is April 8th, March 24th.
All right.
Yeah. I have my built-in causes. And so, you know, that's kind of the way that I was able to say some of the things that, you know, I hadn't been able to say in life, you know, in the text.
So read us a section from this book about the heaven and hell banquet, the saints versus sinners banquet, which I love.
It actually reminds me of the Tennessee with William Smith now that I think about it.
I know, the saints and sinners festival.
And this is from the point of view of Priscilla.
Right.
I walked into the fellowship hall alone, looking at everything and spreading around a couple of how you doings before settling down. Dora and them had really done a nice job on the decorations. A wide burgundy runner split the room in stark halves, which you weren't supposed to cross until after benediction, when salvation breached the gap. Hell, on the left, was lit in red and black crepe flames with a few giant splashes of white lightning to illuminate the doom that awaited the unrepentant sinner. The ticket to hell was $10, and members of the sustenance ministry served the Hellraisers fried chicken, fish, spaghetti, coleslaw, dinner rolls, and devil's food cake. On the other side of the runner was heaven. The tables were decorated with tinfoil stars and tissue paper clouds. The ticket was $15 in recognition of the higher cost of salvation, the fight and sacrifice, the struggle to get and stay righteous. On the menu was baked chicken and fish, mashed potatoes, green beans, salad, dinner rolls, and angel food cake. Hell was packed, but there was only one full table in heaven. There sat a handful of church mothers plus Melva Steen, Brenda Gale, and Hattie. Although I didn't want to, I had to sit with them. Loudmouth Melva Steen was running the conversation, going on and on about the Eastern Stars, when Bertha sashayed in, wearing the dress I told her to throw away after her mama's funeral. She aimed a little sheepish smile at me, but I made sure she saw me rolling my eyes good and hard. I should have known better, though. Every year she brought a ticket to hell. She never could resist nothing fried. You could fry air in despair and Bertha would want a piece. Applause sprung out of nowhere, and I turned to see Saber gliding through in that white suit. From somewhere, he'd acquired a silvery, sparkly sash that he had fastened across himself. He strode over to the makeshift podium in front of the baptismal pool. His hands rose, and so did the church, to his feet, and he officially opened the program. Heaven or hell, it's your choice, he said. I think I'll say that again.
I love that. And he steps out.
So, like, right before this, they're having this argument. He comes out in this white double-breasted monstrosity. And so...
Of course. The angelic arrival.
Exactly. I
If you're just joining us, my guest is Addie Kitchens. Her much-anticipated debut novel is Dominion. Now, this book takes place during the reaping season, which, of course, calls to mind Jesmyn Ward's book, Men We Reaped. So talk a little bit about that.
So this was purely off of my high school years in Clarksdale. Mm-hmm. It was a time, in that time, that there was so much going on. And it was exactly like I said it in the book, you know, that was borrowed straight from real life. It seems like kids were dying like every weekend, like gang violence. Kids were going out flipping cars. It just seemed like a lot was happening. And so I don't know why I used that in the novel, but that kind of stuck with me. And so I think it became a theme. And well, it did become a theme in the novel because that.
It does. We all go hit those periods of.
Right. It's right.
Of loss, where so much is gone so quickly.
Yeah.
And I love it that Reverend Winfrey tells everybody they better stay prayed up.
Right.
Because so many people are, you know, leaving Dominion. So talk a little bit about writing Emmanuel Winfrey or Wonder Boy, because all the women are obsessed with him and he is a central figure. So what was it like creating that kind of energy?
It was fun at times. It was terrifying at times. Mm-hmm. It was a learning experience. He was gleaned from boys I knew. He was gleaned from TV crime shows. He was gleaned from movies. Because, you know, on the outside, that character is so polished and perfect, but he's mm-hmm. an entirely different person. And so I did all of those things. It was a lot of research. And in Mississippi, they call it a boy wonder. Uh-huh. And so it's usually a boy whose father is normally a pastor, and he is great at playing a piano, or he's a great singer, or he's declared he's going to be called to the ministry fairly early in life. Mm-hmm. And so it was a combination of all of those things that went into creating the character Emmanuel Winfrey.
Well, talk about his relationship with his father, too.
He has this typical, he's an overachiever. And so his father is just like a hard driving father. He's like a stage dad. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you lose a lot of sensitivity in parenting when you see your child as a machine. And I think that's what Sabre saw his son as. He's a mm-hmm. machine without the need for tenderness, without the need for encouragement. He just needed criticism to get it right. And mm-hmm. so I think he didn't know. I mean, Sabre didn't know how to parent the type of child he was. And as a teenager, Emmanuel didn't know what he needed. And he was just acting out of that fact that he didn't know what he needed and didn't know how to get it.
And Priscilla thinks of him in a different way.
Right. And so she's enamored with him at first. But then she's also always known that there was something not quite right about him. And so she's seeing him, I guess, really at this time, it's undeniable. And part of her conscience wants to punish him, but part of her conscience doesn't want to because she's afraid of the reflection that would have on her. Because she says something like, it's always the mom, yeah. whatever, you know. Whatever happens, because that's the first thing you do when you look at serial killers on crime shows. It's like the first thing they say is like, it's the mom's yep. fault, you know? And so I think she's fighting seeing him for who he is just because of what it looks like mm-hmm. on her.
And of course, the older he gets, the more frightened she can become.
Right. She is frightened of him, you know?
And he's handsome. He's talented. But he's dark.
Right. And it's so hard. If he's handsome, he's talented, and that's all people see.
Yeah.
You know, and whether that darkness is there or not, people are willing to overlook a lot mm-hmm. for handsome and talent. And especially in a small Mississippi town that wants something to pin their hopes on.
Well, everybody wants the men to be good. Priscilla says she wants her husband to be as good a man as he proclaims himself to be.
Right. And she wants her sons to be that, too. But, you know, it's not necessarily the case.
And Diamond wants him to be.
Definitely.
Good too. Talk about that young woman who is so incredible.
She needs a family. That's what she wants.
Yeah.
And she overlooks a lot because she feels like they have something they created and something she can hold on to. So Diamond has, you know, just absorbed a lot of loss in her life. And she's lost her parents. She's lost her siblings. And she wants something she can keep. And mm-hmm. so she's willing to overlook a lot of things, a lot of issues that she can see in him for keeping her family together. He's mm-hmm. her family in this story. And so she wants that. She doesn't want him to be yet another thing she loses.
I love that she gets the last word.
Yeah.
You know, it's nice to have this young woman coming along, seeing a way.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Because, you know, so often where I'm from, if you get married, you're legitimized in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's that idea that this man is a prize to be gained and be kept and not to have anybody or anything taken away, you know. And so I'm glad she grows to see herself as the center of her world and is going right. to act accordingly after that. And I think, you know, that's a journey most people who are not men have to take, because we see men as the center of the world. They say mankind, you know, we don't mm-hmm. say people kind. They say mankind is just not a spectrum of other people habitating the earth. So I think she had to decenter him mm-hmm. and decenter the ideas that she always had about being legitimized by a relationship. And I think Priscilla tries to do this as well, you know, and she does for a while, you know. And I was proud of the steps she took, no matter how it turned out. I think these women are both trying to free themselves in so many ways.
They are. I love the way Priscilla takes off on her bike and is free.
Right.
And rides around town and goes wherever she wants and gets her little fulfillment in pill form. It's so daunting that they're so beaten down by public expectation. Mm-hmm. But I think preachers' wives and families do suffer from that.
Right.
And will always, don't you think?
Precisely. Precisely. And then it doesn't matter what he does, you know.
Yeah.
They still bear the blame in so many ways. But yeah, exactly. They're caged by their expectations, other people's expectations of their behavior. And I think that's what happened to Emmanuel especially, but also Priscilla.
And one of the things that's interesting to me is that they interact with the whole town, not just the people in the church, the whole town.
Right.
You know, it's just an amazing thing. One of the beautiful things about this book is that the big themes are so big and so beautifully done. But the little details get you all the way through. I mean, you'll be reading along, you'll come to a phase that says, hot as armpits, or I felt like a hallelujah. And you just stop in your tracks, Addie. It's such pure pleasure on every page. So what was it like to balance that big arc of the book with the linguistic fun of writing it?
So that's just pure Mississippi for me. You know, that's that Mississippi thing. I wrote an article that's in Mississippi Folklife magazine about Early Wright, and he was the first African-American DJ in the Deep South, we think. He was at a Clarksdale radio station, and he had gotten discovered because he was doing some kind of announcements, and the way he did them, the way he strung his words between each other and his choice of words, and that comes from, like, half of it comes from being, in some ways, wiser than the system. Some of it's being undereducated. So it's just that Mississippi thing where, you know, we improvise, you know. And so I think it's purely like, also my grandmother, she only got like a second grade education, but she was so witty and she could always turn a phrase like nobody's business. And so I think I was just picking those things up. Also preachers in the pulpit, they always had a way of putting words together. And so I think it's just me observing and absorbing those mm-hmm. things, you know. It's like even now when you hear me talk, vowel sounds can be very hard for me, especially when I'm talking like off the cuff. And so it's just that combination of like Mississippi, Deep South, mm-hmm. colorfulness. The themes are hard. The story is a hard story, but
yeah,
it's still, I think, very hilarious at times, you know.
Well, that's the thing. Some of it's so funny. I mean, mm-hmm. and you're just carried away by it. It's really a beautiful, beautiful thing. So your first signing will be coming up soon, I'm sure. And how do you feel about stepping out with this book?
Oh, you know, it's daunting, but this is something I kind of feel like I've been preparing for my entire life. I always love to read, of course, as writers do. And my mom was friends with a librarian when she was a teacher. And the librarian, Miss Brent, God rest her beautiful soul, she gave us tons and tons of books as her daughter grew out of them. And so we were reading all these Little House on the Prairie books, Sweet Valley High, yeah, you know.
Yep.
And I was reading those books when I was too young to be reading most of them because my mom had already taught us how to read at home before we went to school. Mm-hmm. So we were devouring everything. And so as soon as I started trying to read, I started trying to write my own stories. In middle school, I would write stories and the kids would pass them around till we all got in trouble. So I've always been trying to write this book. And so it being here now at this point in my life, it's overwhelming, and I'm humble and I'm excited, but I'm also terrified.
There is something about holding the object in your hands.
Yes. So let me tell you about that. A couple of weeks ago, I was just sitting at the house and my partner brought out this package and I'm like, what is this? And this is from FSG. I wonder what this is. And I opened it and it was the first copy of the book and I screamed.
Oh.
And I was like, I text my editor. I'm like, Jenna, why did you do this to me? And she was like, oh, you don't like surprises. No, you should have set me up for that because I could have fainted at that moment. So yeah, it was like.
That's kind of wonderful though.
It was a wonderful surprise, you know, like the good trouble thing, the good work, you know, so I was, yeah. So that's kind of like where I am on this journey.
We've been talking with Addie Kitchens, whose brilliant first novel is Dominion. Don't miss it. Addie, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. There will be a children's book sale Friday, August 15th from noon to 4 and Saturday, August 16th from 10 to 3 at the Norman Mayer Library, 3001 Gentilly Boulevard. Friends of the New Orleans Public Library is sponsoring this event. One Book, One New Orleans celebrates Books for Brews Saturday, August 6th from 1 to 4 at Urban South Brewery, 1645 Chapatoulas. Bring paperback books for Louisiana Books to Prisoners to exchange for beer. Naomi S. DeBerry, author of My Daddy Needs a Gift, and Shannon Kelly Atwater, author of Fade O'Doe, along with the ladies of the New Orleans Baby Dolls, appear Saturday, August 16th from 2:30 to 4:30 at Ladder Library. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.